Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting, broadcasting, broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world, to the world, to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
I'm a honky-tonk man, and I can't seem to stop. I love to give the girls a whirl to the music of an old jukebox. But when my money's all gone, I'm on the telephone, hollering, hey, hey, mama, can your daddy come home? I'm living fast and dangerously, but I've got plenty of company. When the moon comes up and the sun goes down, that's when I want to see the lights of town. Cause I'm a honky-tonk man, and I can't seem to stop. I love to give the girls a whirl to the music of an old jukebox. But when my money's all gone, I'm on the telephone, hollering, hey, hey, mama, can your daddy come home? Stop. I love to give the girls a whirl to the music of an old jukebox. But when my money's all gone, I'm on the telephone, hollering, hey, hey, mama, can your daddy come home? Can your daddy come home?
Well, greetings. And welcome to Topically Yours on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul. And as always, I'm your host, Deirdre Schuler. Well, you know, with movies popping up like Django, The Butler, and now 12 Years a Slave, the question of race is being spotlighted. There is much emotion tied to race and the discussion of race, who's culpable, and what prompts racism, in fact. What is it that makes people hate another simply due to the color of their skin? Is it fear? Is it ignorance? Is it object denial and refusal to delve into the cause, or even worse, the effect? What drives this hate that has crippled America? And everyone in America knows that racism is sewn into America's fabric. An America whose preamble is freedom for all, yet it's built on the backs of slaves. I have with me today a playwright who's written a dark comedy, and he's entitled it, of all names, Honky, a derogatory term used against the Caucasian race, as some of you may know. But my guest, Grave Kellers, or Kelleris, he may help me in that pronunciation when he comes on, via his play, takes his audience into an ad agency where we see SkyMax sneakers designed, that was designed by a black designer, being hyped with the logo, "The sneakers are so desirable, people are willing to kill to get them." And this happened after a black teen was killed for his SkyMax sneakers. Mr. Keller has received a BGA from Tisch's writing program at NYU. He has produced several plays in cities such as in several cities, even in Beirut, Lebanon. Honky was reviewed in the New York Times and picked as its critical pick. His critics pick, and his one-act plays have won top honors at the Samuel French Festival, the Turnip Festival, and the Fusion Theater. Kellers makes an attempt to deal with the issues of race and how race is often used by advertisers. The playwright also addresses the issues of white guilt. So we have Greg Kellers with us today, and why don't we let him explain his play? How are you, Greg? Well, I see that.
Oh, good. Who knows how long I've been talking.
Where were you born and raised?
I was raised in Indianapolis, Indiana, kind of the heart of the country.
Mm,
and Exactly, exactly. And I moved to New York I went to NYU in 96. So I've been here ever since.
And did you grow up in a diverse neighborhood?
No. The area I grew up in was very, very white, that I recall. I went to public high school, which was very diverse, but relatively socially segregated, you know, just as is, you know, typically, for the most part, yeah.
So what prompted you to focus on race and racial issues in your play?
I worked in advertising for about 5 years. I was a copywriter for shoe companies. I worked on Nike and brand Jordan for a few years, and I wanted to write about my experiences being a white copywriter, writing for brands that were targeted towards black audiences. I had many experiences, you know, that very revealing experiences, being in various boardrooms with people discussing, you know, their demographic. As you know, advertising, for the most part, is a very white industry, and I just found it interesting how white it is and how much, you know, they're targeting non-white demographics and how little comfort that the industry has with discussing its own demographics. You know, being in rooms with people where no one really knew what words to use. You know, at some point there would be a protective sort of, you know, bubble in the boardroom where you weren't talking about stereotypes, you were talking about demographics. And I found that interesting. I found it interesting the language people would use, what they could say, what they couldn't say, what they felt comfortable saying. And ultimately, I wanted to write a play that dealt with, yes, racism, yes, race in advertising, but also language and how language can be its own sort of the own – it's an antagonist in the play itself. Each character in the play sort of deals with its language in a different way and either suffers from an inability to express how they feel or what they should say or how they should say it. And this causes lots of different issues in the play.
But in the advertising agencies, when they're discussing how they're going to present their ads and if they're targeting a certain community, why wouldn't they have representatives of that community employed?
Well, that's a great question. Sometimes they do. I mean, there's no question that I've worked with a number of black strategists and copywriters or art directors, but the ratio is very obviously. It's a very the discrepancy is very great. So that's. I mean, if it was all white people all the time, the discomfort that some of the people felt would be less. But because that's not the case, I think that, you know, there's a lot of tiptoeing because, you know, I think for the most part they can admit that they're not really sure how to talk about what they're talking about without saying something potentially politically incorrect, you know, and, you know, that fear makes people react in very weird ways, you know. So
they generally ended up stumbling all over themselves and saying what they didn't want to say in the first place.
That's exactly right. And I think because no one has the language to talk about these things, we end up making the situation much worse, you know, and the divide gets much greater, I think. So the play itself, I'd like to think, is, you know, is a sort of way to get people talking, you know, and it does. Our audiences are great evidence of that. That, you know, if you stand outside the lobby after the play, we should just put a tape recorder in there, and we have a whole other play in itself.
Well, I was there to your play, and afterwards, you had the audience could remain and discuss it with I guess it was you and the director. And
Yeah, we've had a few talkbacks. It's been nice.
Mm-hmm. Because I think that what your play does encourage, as you say, is the ability to at least establish dialogue. And I think that's what's it's pretty much needed, because there's so many misconceptions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it's I think that's the. I mean, obviously, as the writer, I want people to enjoy themselves, and I want them to laugh, and I want them to see themselves in these characters, and I want them to relate, and I want them to think. But what I think outside of the being a writer and watching your play on stage, I really love it when people are able to talk about these things. So many people have come to me afterwards and just said, you know, it's so funny. Since seeing this play, I found myself thinking about things differently and talking to people in a different way about this topic, because the language is so out there on this play. It's like it says everything. So, you know, and whether you're offended by it or you're tickled by it or you find it cathartic, you want to talk about it. And the whole audience kind of feels like they're all in the same boat with this. So there's a certain level of camaraderie in a way. In that discomfort.
Do you think that people can better digest the sensitive nature of race because it is a comedy?
Yes, I think, I don't know, but, you know, it's a good question, because some people, I think, might be offended by the fact that you can make jokes about something that is, you know, affects many people, you know, every day. So there's that element where there are people that find this not a topic to be laughed about. I personally find that humor, the way me as a writer, the way I write, I often use humor as a way to put people off their guard. So it doesn't feel like we're spoon feeding people some sort of medicine they have to take, and it's not a lesson you have to learn. The play is not trying to make you change your mind about the way the world works. It is just opening your eyes and hopefully making you, you know, see something in yourself. Yeah, I mean, maybe. I mean, I hope that would be cool. I certainly don't set out to change anybody's mind, but I like it when people say, you know, it certainly made me think about things in a different way, and that's always nice. That's always nice to hear. And I think humor allows people in a way that doesn't feel alienating.
Well, you did mention that you did commercials for Nike and Brand Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the focus designer making sneakers called SkyMax.
Yes.
So, obviously, you believe your experiences are always play out somehow in your writing?
No. This was a unique experience for me, because I wrote this play right after I left advertising. I certainly write about things that I can relate to, or that, you know, usually what I write about is things I don't understand, or I'm confused about, or I find confounding or scary, you know. And that's, you know, there were so many things that I left on the table just emotionally, I think, for me with that job that I wanted to explore and find out about. And so I used my experience in advertising as a gateway. But for the most part, when I'm writing, I usually don't take from my life, because it gets boring.
Well, now, I'm sure you've been asked this question several times, but why did you name your play Honky?
There are a couple reasons. The word is used a few times in the play. It's a very antiquated insult. You know, you don't hear it very often anymore.
Exactly.
And so there's a certain level of humor that is associated to it, you know. So because it's a play about language and race, I wanted to use a word that we associate with language and race. Also, there's like one of the main characters of the play, his name is Thomas, and he is a black designer, shoe designer.
Mm-hmm.
And he grew up in a wealthy white neighborhood. Designing this shoe for a traditionally black shoe company has always made him feel as though he's still you know, was
community.
Exactly, quote unquote, you know, black enough, you know, and I think that, and when he was a kid, he used to be called honky by kids in the other neighborhoods because he was in this white neighborhood, and so he was called honky and being black, and that to me seemed interesting to me because the idea of white guilt from the perspective of a black person is very interesting to me. So that was the other reason why I titled it Honky.
Yeah, because as you say, I rarely hear the word honky ever.
Yeah. Well, you know what's funny? This is a true story. After the there was an argument the audiences have been so interesting in this play. You never know how they're going to react. And there was an altercation during one of the performances. This young black woman was, I guess, texting or something during the show, and the white guy got angry, and, you know, and they're, you know, going back and forth or whatever, and, you know, someone stops them to keep it quiet during the show. And then after the show, she turned around and yelled at him and said called him a honky, but without irony. Like, as if she had forgotten that the play that she was in, and her friends are looking at her, like, and they're really embarrassed, and he's feeling weird because the play that they're in, it was like a reflection of the play. It was so weird. She actually used the term honky, and without a wink, you know. It was a very meta moment.
That'd be interesting to know the origins of the word or how it came about. You wouldn't happen to know, would you?
You know, I've heard a number of different theories. I might be wrong, but I'm sure that there's a linguist who understands this exactly, but from what I understand, there's a number of different theories. One of them that I always thought was interesting was that in the turn of the century, white men would wait outside their cars and honk for prostitutes in black neighborhoods.
Oh.
And the young black men would call them honkies. That was one theory I've heard that I've read about, and I thought that was kind of an interesting that was kind of interesting to me. I've also heard it coming up as a variation of a bow hunk, and I've also heard things that had something to do with a sort of a West African derivation, but of some word that was used to describe white people. But I always thought that one was the one that was the most interesting to me.
I can't even think of a racist word that they use for whites now outside of cracker.
Tell me about it. I know. I actually wrote a piece for the Times about that exact thing, and the title of my piece was called "How do you offend a white person?" And what the word I found that was the most offensive to a white person is racist.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, if you really want to make a white person lose sleep, or at least I should say, a liberal-minded, you know, there's a certain level of people that, you know, there's certain people that will just, they'll lose sleep. You call them a racist, and that's it. They won't get that out of their heads for, you know, weeks. It's just a very, you know, it's a very sensitive button. I kind of found that funny in a way. It's somewhat ironic, but yeah. No,
well,
you're
especially
exactly right.
Since I always hear them tagging liberals as people that get overly sensitive about any black issue.
Exactly, which is exactly why.
But
exactly.
liberal, racist, liberty.
Me? Are you kidding?
Hmm?
Yeah. It's like, me, racist, are you kidding? What? No, I, you know, I have a black friend, and are you kidding? I love the play, you know, counts on that sort of silliness, you know, that humor of the idea that so many liberal whites, you know, me being one of them, it's like, you know, you have any hint of being a racist and you immediately sound like an idiot defending yourself, you know? The play definitely touches on that a lot.
Well, there's something in the news today about Juliet Hong, I guess her name is Hong, H-O-U-G-H, who dressed up for Halloween in her favorite character on the new prison show, Black or Orange or something like that it's called. Do you know the name of it?
Oh, right. Orange is the New Black.
Yep, Orange is the New Black. And she just dressed up like her favorite character, who happened to be black. And the Huffington Post decided that was the most offensive thing ever, And basically, I don't even think black people would have been worried about that. What, you know, she imitation. What did they say about imitation?
Highest form of flattery.
It's the highest form of flattery.
Right, right. Well, it's, you know, it's interesting to hear you say that. I don't know. I mean, because it also harkens back to, you know, blackface. You know, it harkens back to various other stereotypical.
Well, she didn't look like Al Jolson. I mean, she looked like a white person that had a terrible tan.
Exactly. This is not someone who's maliciously going out to be offensive. This is someone who is actually doing it probably out of reverie.
Exactly.
But then the question is, okay, knowing that, and this is the thing that I always find interesting because I don't know, knowing that she's going out, you know, and doing this to be like, hey, I love this character. I want to be this character. Okay, we know that that's true, but most people don't. And you have to understand when you do that that you're taking on a certain level of responsibility to defend how you've done this because there are people that are very sensitive and they won't take it that way. They won't see you and say, yeah, you're totally just – you're into that character. No, they'll say that's offensive because so many people are so – race issue is so complicated and so personal to so many different people that you cannot predict how anyone would react to something like that.
Well, if we didn't have a racist society, we wouldn't even, that would be a nothing.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yes, if we didn't have a racist society, we wouldn't have to worry about it, unfortunately. Yeah.
Exactly. But let me get back to Hunky. Because in the play, you come up with a cure for racist and racism, even those that deny or are in denial of their racism. So tell me about the pill.
Yes. In the play, there is a pill called Driscoll, created by Dr. Leonard Driscoll. And the pill claims to rid you of racism. Obviously... You know, there's a certain what I was toying with was the idea of the quick fix to something that is obviously not a quick. Nothing can quickly fix racism, but in this society, everyone takes a pill for anything. They take a pill for anxiety, for depression, for erectile dysfunction. Why not one for racism? And obviously, it's an absurd, satirical concept. But because the play is about advertising, what I really wanted to play with was the idea that they sell the pill by relying on guilt about racism. So they'll say, hey, if you take this pill, you know, we're not saying you're racist, but if you take this pill, we can't. You know, like, you are absolved of all, you know, accusations because you're taking
the pill. But how does the pill does it wipe out memory?
No, well, it's never discussed. There is some junk science mentioned in the play about how it works, but ultimately I leave it up to the audience to decide whether or not the pill is a cure or the pills taking the pill itself is the cure. Is it really stopping people from thinking racist thoughts, or is it just they take it because they want to be able to say they're taking it and therefore don't have to be ever accused of racism, or, you know, does taking the pill alone work as almost a placebo? It's more of an absurdist theatrical idea and seeing how that would play out, you know, with these characters that are in the play. And, of course, obviously there's no quick fix, so that's kind of the silliness of it. But playing it straight and seeing where we go with that is what's fun about it.
Well, now you have two black characters in the play.
Four.
Four?
Yeah. There's two kids who come on the subway
three
times,
right.
And they're kind of the Greek chorus of the play. And then there's, Thomas and Amelia.
Oh, yes, that's right. I forgot about the two kids, and they were instrumental in the play. How could I forget? The two main characters, two black main characters, they both seem to be out of touch with themselves and their race. Would you say that's the case?
I would. I would say that they are out of touch in different ways.
Exactly.
Now,
the psychiatrist, for example, how would you say she's out of touch?
I would say that she wants so badly to not have race be an issue in her life that she almost naively believes that it's not an issue in anyone's life, and that she can be a psychiatrist like she should be in any world that would be great, where no one ever considers the color of her skin. And she assumes that they look at her and she's a psychiatrist and she helps people, and never once has it crossed their mind that she is black. And she wants so badly to believe that she's willing to hold on to that truth to the, I think, the detriment of her own identity. And
in the end, she almost goes nuts, right?
Yes. Well, in the end, she takes the pill. She has to take the pill. And it's sort of, yeah, exactly. She takes the pill because she's dealing with the white copywriter who is seeing her, and he has so much white guilt that clearly all he sees when he looks at her is a black woman, not a therapist. And this drives her to a strange place in the play. And then her brother, Thomas, is the black shoe designer, and his issue with race is that, you know, as I said, he grew up, you know, wealthy and in a white neighborhood, but he's always felt guilty about that. And he's so conflicted always. He knows he should be angry about certain things, but so he forces himself to be angry about certain things. And he knows that he knows he has to talk differently in the office than he does with maybe his sister or with in that the sort of duality of being a successful black man in America, and is what he deals with, is his own sort of conflict. And when he falls for a white woman, this really confuses him because, you know, she is the opposite of him. He thinks about everything about race. Everything is to him, everything is race, everything is race, everything is race. And to her, she says whatever's on her mind, has no filter, often says the most offensive things in the world, guilelessly, you know, because she just doesn't think about it, irresponsibly, you know,
and she seems like she's more attracted to the stereotype than the real man.
Well, in the play, I think that she originally sees him because her husband, her fiance, is feeling so much guilt about the commercial that he wrote that led to the death of a young black male that he feels that he keeps pushing on her that he's, you know, this, that he cares about the black race and all this stuff. And it's so silly and absurd because he's, you know, it's contrived. And so she sees this black man at a shoe party that she was supposed to go to meet her husband. And the two of them start talking, and then it's no longer about race. It's just about her actually liking this guy because he's smart and cool, and he, you know, actually doesn't let her get away with everything she says. You know, he actually calls her on her irresponsibility with language. And so she ultimately, in the play, the two of them actually have the most, as complicated as the relationship is, they have the most pure relationship in the play.
Well, most of white people do not have to face the issues of race unless they're directly confronted by it. So it seemed the white advertiser, when he came up with the idea of marketing this guy, Max Shoes, and the slogan for it, he didn't care that it was glorified as a result of street violence, because his whole idea was profit, and that's why he didn't understand why the black shoe designer was not eager to market utilize his marketing strategy.
Yes.
Would you say?
Yeah, I think that's right, yeah.
Because
I mean,
here's a guy that never had, he's separated from all of that. He's in privilege.
Exactly. I mean, the CEO of the company, you know, he doesn't understand because he's looking at it from a marketing perspective. To him, he's using white guilt to sell the shoes. And he doesn't understand why can't we talk about this? We're talking about demographics. We're not talking about stereotypes. We're talking about I'm a marketer. I'm a salesman. I'm using what I use to sell the shoes. Why are we talking about race here? This is a boardroom. Out there, he has a speech where he says, out there, it may
but
be
it's
racist.
Beyond just race. It's also violence. Somebody died as a result of others stealing his shoes.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And it's just, you know, which is just to highlight, you know, the absolute, you know, unself-awareness, you know, the lack of self-awareness that he has, and, you know, and so out of touch with his own
lack of compassion.
Yes, yes.
But is that what happens in the advertising world, that they're so caught up with the profit and making money that the human equation has completely been ignored?
You know, I can't speak to that. In my experience, no, that is not the case. In my experience, I've been in, you know, like I took the play to a hyperbolic level to point out some things that I thought were interesting and humorous, but more about it being interesting and expose some things. But I can't probably speak to that level of understanding. I've been in situations where people have forgotten, you know, that they're talking about human beings, and it comes off cold and, ignorant. And so I've definitely been in those conversations. So what I did was take that and I put it to the nth degree to see how it would play out.
I think it played out pretty well. You got your point across. I also want to mention that you were a lead writer on the award-winning This Is Sports Center campaign. Tell me about the campaign. Tell me about that.
Oh yeah, no. Well, This Is Sports Center is a. I don't know if you know those commercials. They've been on for gosh now, over 15 years probably. I didn't come up with it. I didn't. You know, it was a campaign that's been running for years, and it's brilliant, and you know, very funny, and it's based on the idea of the sports world living in Bristol, Connecticut, where Sports Center is based, and so you know, athletes. And mascots and everything all kind of happens in the office, you know, there. And it's been running for years as promos for ESPN Sports Center show, which is their highlight show and, you know, sports news. And I was lucky enough to spend some time at Wieden & Kennedy where I was able to write a number of those commercials as a copywriter. And you know, I think I wrote about 17 or 18 of those, and they were fun. They're so fun. And you're right about sports.
Is it Monday yet? Is that yours? Is it Monday yet?
That was for football. Yeah. That was the first campaign.
Monday
was called Monday. Yeah, Monday Night Football. Yeah, the ESPN did Monday Night Football, and they do it still. I'm not sure it's the same campaign, but they did that campaign for about 3 years, I think, after I left.
Nice. That must have helped promote some of your work.
Not really. You don't put your name on anything that goes out as a commercial. It's funny how incredibly separate the writing I do for advertising, the writing I do for theater and film is. It's just two different worlds.
No, I meant in terms of making a profit in order to finance your plays.
Oh, yes. Well, yes, now. I mean, thank God I have advertising. I'm able to freelance a lot. So if I need a pair of pants, I can always write an ad, which is really nice because theater doesn't really, you know, put a roof on the house as much as advertising does. So, fortunately, I've been able to work on, you know, campaigns that are actually fun to write for, you know, sports and, you know, things like that, which is, you know, it could be worse. I could be writing for toilet paper.
Well, now let me ask you about what's happening with the play, your play. Where is it? And is it touring, or what's the status?
We're going up again. We have a remount that's happening right now. Opening night is tonight. In fact, I'm heading up there in 5 minutes for opening night. We're really happy that they're at Urban Stages. You can go to urbanstages.org, and they have all the information. And it's like we're going up tonight we're October 27th to November 17th. And we're going up again, so I'm really excited about it.
So you say it's Urban Stages, so folks can call over there for tickets if they want to.
Absolutely, yeah. UrbanStages.org is the website, and Urban Stages is the theater. And it's on 30th Street between 7th and 8th Avenues. It's a great space, and you know they do a lot of great work. And Francis Hill, the artistic director, has been very supportive of this play, and the whole team has been great. And we have a great cast. The same cast from before is back with one change. We have one cast change, so it's been really great.
Now, just give the street again. I think I heard 30th Street. Is that what you said?
Yes, it's 30th between 7th and 8th Avenues.
Okay, at the Urban Stages.
It's 259 30th Street.
Oh, that helps a lot.
I guess I should give an address. I don't know. I'm so used to giving web addresses, I forget there's an actual address.
Yeah. And let me ask you also that's not your only play. You have another one out called, or is it out? It's called Wreck.
Wrecked is a new play that I'm working on now. We're doing a workshop in a couple of weeks, and with some friends that I kind of wrote it for, this theater company that they kind of commissioned, and they're called Three Jennies, and they commissioned this play, and so we're going to start doing a workshop of it in 2 weeks, so I'm really excited about that, too.
Great. And what is the – you have a screenplay.
I've
been moving around in the different genres.
I'm trying. Staying busy, which is nice. A couple of screenplays out there, and working on a TV project as well. And so, yeah, staying busy, which is nice.
Well, what is Last Day Man about?
Last Day Man is it's a movie about it's based on the idea of the fact that nobody wants to live their last day of life. And so, it's about these characters, these people that actually live it for you. They're these beings that come down and live your last day of life for you. And, the main character comes down and he lives this guy's last day, and he meets a woman who he recognizes from one of his many last days. He lived her husband's last day of life. And he remembers her, and they had this beautiful day together, and he fell in love. But, of course, she saw it as her husband. And now that he sees her again, he wants to, for the first time ever, try to live. And so the movie is a sort of dark comedy about this guy living in someone else's body, having to sort of, avoid death and find love all in one day.
Well, Ruth Montgomery in her books talks about that. They call walk-ins.
Oh, that's interesting. What is that?
People that are emotionally depressed and just say to God, I can't go on, I can't go on. And so a spirit takes over their body and lives out the rest of their life for them.
Whoa, I have to look that up.
So they can accomplish their mission.
That's really interesting. Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah.
I wrote a play like 10 years ago. That is so interesting. I'm writing this down.
Yeah, Ruth Montgomery writes a whole book on it. It's called Walk-Ins. And then they mention it. Just look it up on the internet and you'll see it.
I will. Thank you so much.
You're certainly welcome. And, we got 5 more minutes that I want to fill, so I'm going to ask you what your play Wrecked is about. You might as well fill people in so that out there they know
Wrecked,
what they're getting into.
I haven't distilled this one down yet to a good elevator pitch, but I guess I would say it's about two couples. One is considered the perfect couple that everyone looks at and wants to be around because they're so great and everyone loves being around them, and they're so functional and so never have any problems. And then there's another couple that's kind of more fledgling couple that is constantly in, upset and miscommunicating and not understanding how to talk to one another. And the play opens where the perfect couple has just come in from an event, and they think they may or may not have hit something with their car and driven on. And so they have to sort of try to understand if they can get on the same page and remember what they saw and whether or not it's real or not, they both have to be on the same page and believe that they either didn't hit this thing or that what they hit was a small animal and not a person, you know, and so they have, in order to move on with their lives, they have to sort of figure that out. And then this other couple comes over and it becomes a sort of comedy of manners, but it's very kind of a dark suspense comedy about this horrible thing that may or may not have happened and two couples and how they operate when something like this is going on.
You seem to make people delve into their guilt.
Yes, I guess I do. That's probably a good way to say it.
Well,
I guess it's more me delving into my own guilt.
Well, I think everyone has it.
Yeah.
But
it's
has to be opened and to face them, and a lot of people hide from them and deny them, but somehow doors have to be open, and so they have to, or windows to look in.
Yeah, I think you're
into
right.
Into oneself, actually.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Do you have a website where interesting parties can read about all your work?
Oh, yeah, I guess. I do have a website. It's just my name, gregcalaris.com. And it's just, you know, it's just a little website that has some of my plays on there, and you can read excerpts or, you know, has some of the press from Honky and, you know, some other stuff that's going on. It's gregcalaris.com.
Okay, and now I'm going to ask you one more question, and sure. That is there anything I haven't asked that you want to say?
No, I mean, I think this has been great. I would say the audiences for Honky have been really great, and I will say everyone has reacted differently. And so it's been really interesting to not have any barometer of how to predict how an audience is going to respond to this play, whether they find it really funny, scary, affecting, or maddening. It's been a roller coaster ride to hear audiences' reactions. I'm curious. I hope it's a selling point and not doesn't scare people away. But I wrote it as a comedy, but everyone responds to it. You know, it laughs at different things. Everyone finds something else, something different, funny about it. So, yesterday I actually said to the lighting designer, I'm like, I'm going to stop predicting on what people will find funny.
Well, that's the point. You want people walk away thinking at least.
But
on that note, I want to just thank you for coming on, Greg Calaris, and
thank you.
Sharing your play Honky with us.
Thank you so much.
And I wish you much luck.
Thanks, Deirdre. I really appreciate it.
And this is Deirdre Schuler on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul, thanking my listeners for making my topic topically yours. And we're going to end the show with a song because I try to find, it's hard to find a song about a honky, so I did Honky Tonk Man at the top. And I'm going to end the show with High Heel Sneakers. And here we go. And I'll put Blue Suede Daddy.
Baby, come on, wear that weekend on your head. You're about to knock on dead. Put on your high heels, sneaker, baby. Gotta wear that weekend on your head. You're gonna knock on dead.
you're gonna knock on dead.
And you've been listening to the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul.